Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for April 24, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shive. On the front page, the headline, Trump Hush Money Trial. Longtime tabloid chief testifies. A veteran tabloid publisher testified Tuesday that he pledged to be Donald Trump's eyes and ears during his 2016 presidential campaign, recounting how he promised the then-candidate that he would help suppress harmful stories and even arranged to purchase the silence of a doorman. The testimony from David Pecker was designed to bolster the prosecution's premise of a decades-long friendship between Trump and the former publisher of the National Enquirer that culminated in an agreement to give the candidate's lawyer a heads-up on negative tips and stories so they could be quashed. The effort to suppress unflattering information was designed to illegally influence the election, prosecutors allege, in striving to elevate the gravity of the first trial of a former American president and the first of four criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. Pecker is the first witness against Trump, who faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with hush money payments meant to prevent harmful stories from surfacing in the final days of the 2016 campaign. Pecker detailed his intimate behind-the-scenes involvement in Trump's rise from political novice to the Republican nomination and the White House. He explained how he and the National Enquirer parlayed rumor-mongering into splashy tabloid stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress seamy stories about Trump, including a porn actor's claim of an extramarital sexual encounter a decade earlier. Pecker traced the origins of their relationship to a 1980s meeting at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, and said the friendship bloomed alongside the success of the real estate developer's TV show, The Apprentice, and the program's subsequent celebrity version. Their ties were solidified during a pivotal August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower involving Trump, his lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen, and another aide, Hope Hicks, in which Pecker was asked what he and the publications he led could do for the campaign. Pecker said he volunteered to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. He said he told Trump, "I will be your eyes and ears. I said that anything I hear in the marketplace, if I hear anything negative about yourself, or if I hear about women selling stories, I would notify Michael Cohen so that the rights could be purchased and the stories could be killed, so they would not get published," asked prosecutor Joshua Steinglass. "So they would not get published," Pecker replied. To illustrate their point, prosecutors displayed a screenshot of various flattering headlines the National Enquirer published about Trump, including "Donald Dominates" and "World Exclusive, the Donald Trump Nobody Knows." The jury was also shown disparaging and outlandish stories about Trump's opponents, including Surgeon Ben Carson and Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Pecker painted Cohen as a shadow editor of the National Enquirer's pro-Trump coverage, directing the tabloid to go after whichever Republican candidate was gaining momentum. "I would receive a call from Michael Cohen, and he would direct me and direct Dylan Howard which candidate and which direction we should go," Pecker said, referring to the tabloid's then-editor. Cohen pleaded guilty in 2018 to federal charges related to his role in the hush money payments. He was once a confidant of Trump's, but their relationship deteriorated in spectacular fashion. Cohen is expected to be a star government witness, and he routinely posts profane broadsides against Trump on social media. Pecker's testimony Tuesday followed a hearing earlier in the day in which prosecutors urged Judge Juan M. Merchan to hold Trump in contempt and fine him $1,000 for each of the 10 social media posts that they say violated an earlier gag order barring attacks on witnesses, jurors, and others involved in the case. Merchan did not immediately rule, but he seemed skeptical of defense arguments that Trump was merely responding in his posts to others' attacks and had been trying to comply with the order. Prosecutors allege that Trump sought to illegally influence the 2016 race through a practice known in the tabloid industry as catch and kill, catching a potentially damaging story by buying the rights to it and then killing it through agreements that prevent the paid person from telling the story to anyone else. In this case, that included a $130,000 payment to porn actor Stormy Daniels to silence her claims of an extramarital sexual encounter that Trump denies. Prosecutors also described other arrangements, including one that paid a former Playboy model $150,000 to suppress claims of a nearly year-long affair with the married Trump, which Trump also denies. Trump's 34 felony counts arise from reimbursements that prosecutors say Trump's company made to Cohen for hush money payments and that were falsely recorded as legal expenses. The charges are punishable by up to 4 years in prison, though it's unclear whether Merchan would seek to put him behind bars. A conviction would not preclude Trump from becoming president again, but because it is a state case, he would not be able to pardon himself if found guilty. He denies wrongdoing. Also on the front page, a story entitled, "Colleges Seek to Balance Safety Protests Amid War in Gaza." From Cambridge, Massachusetts, the University of Michigan informed students of the rules for upcoming graduation ceremonies. Banners and flags are not allowed. Protests are okay, but in designated areas away from the cap and gown festivities. The University of Southern California canceled a planned speech by the school's Muslim valedictorian. At Columbia University, where 100 students were arrested last week following protests, officials temporarily canceled in-person classes Monday as they work to find a resolution to the crisis. This is commencement season 2024, punctuated by the tension and volatility that has roiled college campuses since Hamas' deadly October 7 attack on southern Israel. Militants killed about 1,200 people, most of them civilians, and took about 250 hostages. In response, Israel killed more than 34,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, according to the local health ministry. Since the war began, colleges and universities have struggled to balance campus safety with free speech rights amid intense student debate and protests. Many schools that tolerated protests and other disruptions for months are now doling out more heavy-handed discipline. A series of recent campus crackdowns on student protesters included suspensions and, in some cases, expulsions. Columbia University President Munoosh Shafiq said the Middle East conflict is terrible, and she understands many are experiencing deep moral distress. But we cannot have one group dictate terms and attempt to disrupt important milestones like graduation to advance their point of view, she wrote in a note addressed to the school community on Monday. The new measures have done little to stop protests. As recently as Monday, pro-Palestinian demonstrators set up encampments on campuses around the country, including at Columbia, the University of Michigan, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Yale University, where several dozen protesters were arrested after officials said they defied warnings to leave. protesters want universities to take a number of actions, such as calling for a ceasefire in the war, or divesting from defense companies that do business with Israel. The weapons being made in this country are being sent to Israel and being used in the war on Gaza, and so obviously we have to make those connections, said Craig Burkhead Morton, a Yale senior who was arrested Monday after refusing to leave a protest encampment. We have to highlight the difficulties the Palestinian people are going through. At MIT, protesters who ask the university to stop what they say is funding from the Ministry of Defense in Israel to university projects with military objectives. We believe that we have a platform that students in other universities don't have because of our unique ties to the Israeli military, said Shara Bayan, a 21-year-old senior studying electrical engineering and computer science. The intense emotions on both sides have created a climate that has unsettled both Jewish and Muslim students. More than half of said students and a fifth of all college students reported feeling unsafe on campus because of their stances on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, according to a report published in March by the University of Chicago Project on Security and Threats. Among the commencement speakers likely to encounter protesters is President Joe Biden, who will speak at ceremonies next month for Morehouse College and the U.S. Military Academy. This month, the Anti-Defamation League sent an open letter to college and university presidents urging them to take clear, decisive action to ensure graduation ceremonies run smoothly and safely. We remain deeply concerned regarding the possibility of substantial disruptions during commencement ceremonies, Shira Goodman, the ADL's Senior Director of Advocacy, said in an emailed statement. On Thursday, Shafiq, the Columbia president, summoned New York City police to clear a pro-Palestinian tent camp from the university's campus after student protesters ignored repeated demands to leave, what she described as an extraordinary step to keep the campus safe. All 100 or so students arrested were charged with trespassing, and several were suspended. But as of Monday, a large protest encampment was once again set up on the campus's main lawn, where graduating students and families are set together next month. Several other college campuses around the country kicked off the new year with revised protest rules. In January, American University banned indoor protests. Harvard started the spring semester with guidance effectively limiting protests to outdoor areas. The University of Michigan drafted a proposed disruptive activity policy this month. Violations of the policy, which has not yet been implemented, could result in suspension or expulsion of students and termination of university staff. Last Monday, the University of Southern California cited substantial risks relating to security and disruption at the commencement when it announced it would break from tradition and not allow valedictorian Asna Tabassum, a first-generation South Asian American Muslim, to deliver a speech at the May 10 commencement. The decision sparked outrage and several days of protests on campus, prompting another unexpected shakeup days later, the cancellation of a keynote speaker for the first time since 1942. The events at USC have raised concern that other schools will bow to pressure and erode free speech, said Edward Ahmed Mitchell, a civil rights attorney and national deputy director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. I am worried that the schools might decline to select a qualified, visibly Muslim student who advocates for Palestine to avoid what happened at USC, he said. Schools are going to do more harm than good if they try to censor and silence commencement speakers and especially students who have received the honor of speaking at their graduation ceremonies. On page 2, we find an article entitled "Prehistoric Lake Sturgeon is Not Endangered, U.S. Says." Lake sturgeons don't need Endangered Species Act protections, federal wildlife officials announced, saying that stocking programs have helped the prehistoric fish return to areas where they had vanished. The decision Monday ends the Arizona-based Center of Biological Diversity's petition, filed in May 2018, asking the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list lake sturgeon as endangered or threatened. Such listings would make harvesting the fish illegal, but without them, popular sturgeon harvest seasons in states such as Wisconsin and Michigan can continue. The center argued that overharvesting and deteriorating habitat have severely depleted the species. Dams block access to spawning and rearing habitat, and water pollution and diversions have done irreparable harm, the center said. This is a disappointing decision because although some populations are well managed, overall the lake sturgeon has suffered a drastic decline, said Tierra Curry, a senior scientist at the center. Endangered Species Act protection would bring a comprehensive recovery plan and ongoing funding to restore these iconic fish across their former range. Chuck Traxler, the Wildlife Service's Midwest Deputy Regional Director, said stocking has helped grow adult lake sturgeon populations and increase spawning, agency officials said. Putting creatures on the list would be like going to the emergency room, and the rebounding species doesn't need that level of protection, he said. It doesn't mean everything is good right now, he said. It means keep up the good work. Populations aren't at historical highs, the agency acknowledged in a December assessment, but stocking returned them to the Red River of the North between Minnesota and North Dakota, the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers, parts of the Mississippi River, and the Coosa River. Dam removals and habitat restoration efforts also have helped, the agency said, citing work in 2015 to retrofit a dam on Wisconsin's Menominee River to allow spawning sturgeon to travel upstream, and the removal of the Brecksville Dam on Ohio's Cuyahoga River in 2020. The agency also pointed to reef restoration work in the corridor connecting Lake Huron and Lake Erie that has created a place for sturgeon to lay eggs, and noted that 9 of 43 toxic spots along Great Lakes shorelines have been cleaned up. The assessment also noted the adaptable species should be able to withstand warmer water due to climate change. Lake sturgeon are ancient North American freshwater fish. They're essentially living fossils, first appearing about 130 million years ago, when dinosaurs ruled the planet. They resemble torpedoes with dorsal ridges and snouts. They can grow up to 7 feet long and weigh up to 300 pounds. Males typically live about 50 years. Females live between 80 and 150 years. They're found in the upper and lower Mississippi River Basin, as well as the Great Lakes. Commercial anglers considered lake sturgeon a nuisance because they tore their nets, leading to widespread overharvesting in the 1800s that continued into the 20th century. Lake sturgeon can't reproduce fast enough to replace the losses. It takes up to 3 decades before they reach spawning age, and even then they don't spawn annually, and many don't survive the trip back to their birth waters to spawn. The Wildlife Service has compared lake sturgeon losses to the mass destruction of the American buffalo. 20 states have outlawed sturgeon harvesting. 14 of those states have listed lake sturgeon as threatened or endangered. Volunteers and Wisconsin Natural Resources officials have been guarding spawning sturgeon from poachers on the Wolf River for 30 years. Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin still hold hook and line lake sturgeon fishing seasons. Michigan and Wisconsin hold sturgeon spearing seasons each winter as well, where anglers drill holes through the lake ice and impale sturgeon as they swim past. The Wisconsin Natural Resource Department reported 432 sturgeon were taken in February, down from 1,405 in 2023. Warm weather and poor ice conditions led to the diminished return. Michigan officials set the total harvest limit at just 6 sturgeon, but ended up canceling due to warm weather and unsafe ice conditions. Those states' seasons are so tightly regulated that the harvests don't impact the species overall, said Lori Nordstrom, the Wildlife Services Midwest Assistant Regional Director of Ecological Services. Michigan and Wisconsin, for example, allow an angler to take only 1 sturgeon per year. Minnesota anglers must release any sturgeon they catch in inland waters. Wisconsin regulations are designed to keep the harvest rate below 5%, with all tag fees going to the state's Sturgeon Conservation Program, according to the Wildlife Service. Leaders of Sturgeon for Tomorrow, a nonprofit organization that works to rehabilitate sturgeon in Wisconsin and Michigan and supports harvesting the fish, praised the Wildlife Service's decision on Monday. They said the ruling enables the states to continue managing sturgeon and allows harvesting to continue, which in turn helps researchers learn more about the ancient creatures. We're very happy with it, said Jim Platt, president of the Southwest chapter of the Sturgeon for Tomorrow, one of 5 chapters along the Lake Winnebago system, which hosts Wisconsin spearing season. This is a big thing. We can keep our research going and keep our population strong and continue what we've been doing. On page 3, the lead article, Larry Nassar, Feds agree to pay $138 million. Sports doctor sexually assaulted a gymnast for years before arrest. The U.S. Justice Department announced a $138.7 million settlement Tuesday with more than 100 people who accused the FBI of grossly mishandling allegations of sexual assault against Larry Nassar in 2015 and 2016, a time gap that allowed the sports doctor to continue to prey on victims before his arrest. When combined with other settlements, $1 billion now has been set aside by various organizations to compensate hundreds of women who said Nassar assaulted them under the guise of treatment for sports injuries. Nassar worked at Michigan State University and also served as a team doctor at Indianapolis-based USA Gymnastics. He's now serving decades in prison for assaulting female athletes, including medal-winning Olympic gymnasts. Acting Associate Attorney General Benjamin Meiser said Nassar betrayed the trust of those in his care for decades, and that the allegations should have been taken seriously from the outset. While these settlements won't undo the harm Nassar inflicted, our hope is that they will give the victims of his crimes some of the critical support they need to continue healing, Meiser said of the agreement to settle 139 claims. The Justice Department acknowledges that it failed to step in. For more than a year, FBI agents in Indianapolis and Los Angeles had knowledge of allegations against him, but apparently took no action, an internal investigation found. FBI Director Christopher Wray was contrite and blunt when he spoke to survivors at a Senate hearing in 2021. The assault survivors include decorated Olympians Simone Biles, Allie Raisman, and Michaela Maroney. "I'm sorry that so many different people let you down over and over again," Ray said. "And I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop this monster back in 2015 and failed. After a search, investigators said in 2016 that they found images of child sex abuse and followed up with federal charges against Nassar. Separately, the Michigan Attorney General's office handled the assault charges that ultimately shocked the sports world and led to an extraordinary days-long sentencing hearing with gripping testimony about his crimes. Michigan State University, also accused of missing chances over many years to stop Nassar, agreed to pay $500 million to more than 300 women and girls who were assaulted. USA Gymnastics and the USA Olympic and Paralympic Committee made a $380 million settlement. Next, an article entitled "New Rule Would Prohibit Non-Compete Clauses." The agreements bar employees from jobs in certain instances. U.S. companies would no longer be able to bar employees from taking jobs with competitors under a rule approved by a federal agency on Tuesday, though the rule is sure to be challenged in court. The Federal Trade Commission voted Tuesday, 3-2, to ban measures known as non-compete agreements, which bar workers from jumping to or starting competing companies for a prescribed period of time. According to the FTC, 30 million people, about 1 in 5 workers, are subject to such restrictions. Non-compete measures are commonly associated with high-level executives at technology and financial companies, but also ensnared lower-paid workers, such as security guards and sandwich shop employees. A 2021 study found that more than 1 in 10 workers who earn $20 or less an hour are covered by non-compete agreements. I'll read that again. A 2021 study found that more than 1 in 10 workers who earn $20 or less an hour are covered by non-compete agreements. When it proposed the ban in January 2023, FTC officials asserted that non-compete agreements harm workers by reducing their ability to switch jobs for higher pay. The rule is to take effect in 4 months unless it is blocked by legal challenges. And now an article, Senate okays aid package for Ukraine, other allies. Biden expected to sign legislation that includes potential TikTok ban. The Senate passed $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending the legislation to President Joe Biden after months of delays and contentious debate over how involved the United States should be in foreign wars. The Senate passed the bill on an overwhelming 79-18 vote late Tuesday, after the House approved the package on Saturday. Biden, who worked with congressional leaders to win support, is expected to quickly sign the legislation and start the process of sending weapons to Ukraine, which has been struggling to hold its front lines against Russia. The legislation also would send $26 billion in wartime assistance to Israel and humanitarian relief to Gaza, and $8 billion to counter Chinese threats in Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. The $61 billion for Ukraine comes as the war-torn country desperately needs new firepower. U.S. officials said the Pentagon was preparing about $1 billion of the aid to be on its way shortly. The legislation also would force TikTok's China-based parent company to sell the social media platform under the threat of a ban, a contentious move that's expected to face legal challenges. On the front page today, we find an article entitled "Webster County Budget Approved for 2024-2025. Property tax levy is reduced slightly." A budget of roughly $59 million was unanimously approved by the Webster County Board of Supervisors Tuesday morning. The budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1 and ends June 30, 2025, reduces the property tax levy slightly. It includes a 2% raise for county employees. Nikki Conrad, the chairwoman of the Board of Supervisors, said the newly adopted budget is a testament to the work of Supervisor Mark Campbell and County Auditor Doreen Pliner. "We could not have done it without the both of you," she said. The budget calls for spending $59,248,434. It includes a property tax levy of $6.40 per $1,000 of taxable value. Residents of unincorporated areas of the county would pay an additional $3.67 per $1,000 of taxable value, mainly to help pay for the county's engineering department. That means property owners in the rural parts of the county will pay a total levy of $10.07 per $1,000 of taxable value. The $6.40 per $1,000 of taxable value rate is down from the rate of $6.53 per $1,000 that was introduced on March 26. It is also down from the $6.46 per $1,000 of taxable value now in place. Law enforcement, including the sheriff's office and jail, is the largest expenditure category at $7,516,388. That total includes $400,000 to pay for housing inmates in other counties when the Webster County Jail is full. Other major spending categories in the 2024-2025 budget include $5,195,185 for road maintenance, $4,688,533 for policy and administration, $4,062,345 for roadway equipment and supplies, $3,412,956 for health services, $2,066,315 for central services and information technology, $1,831,250 for legal services, $1,379,364 for county development, and $1,232,950 for conservation and recreation. Also on the front page, an article entitled, "Which Came First? Humboldt Elementary Students Learn About Chickens and Embryology." What came first, the chicken or the egg? Approximately 120 students in Humboldt Community Schools recently learned the embryology of chickens, along with lots of other interesting facts about how chickens are raised, what they are used for, the nutritional value of their eggs, and more. Carlene Burt, Ag in the Classroom Coordinator for the Humboldt County Farm Bureau, and Tristan Torkelson, Youth Coordinator for Iowa State University Extension and Outreach in Humboldt County, recently visited second grade classrooms at Taft Elementary and first grade students at St. Mary's Catholic School in Humboldt for some hands-on learning about chickens. Burt had previously delivered fertile eggs to the schools for each classroom to put into their incubators. Students had time before their lesson to observe how the incubator turns the eggs and provides the necessary heat and moisture in place of the mother hen. The presentation began by showing the students all the different parts of an egg and how these components are important for the development of the embryo. This was followed by a short video explaining how the embryo uses the yolk for nutrition and calcium from the eggshell to develop its bones. Students also learned that chicks have a special egg tooth for hatching. An egg tooth is a tiny horn-like projection at the tip of the upper beak of a newly hatched chick. Soon after the chick hatches, the egg tooth falls off. Eggs from the grocery store were cracked open to show students what all the parts look like, including the air cell, yolk, albumen, membranes, and chalazae, the twisted cord-like strands of egg white that anchor the yolk from the top and the bottom of the shell membrane. Students had the opportunity to use an egg candler from the early 1980s to check the development inside their eggs. Presenters explained that the blood vessels will be the first part students see. They also explained how these are attached to the embryo and to the yolk to provide nutrition to the developing chick. Each classroom also has a set of 21 plastic chick life cycle eggs. The realistic illustrations in each egg allow students to see day-by-day development of a chick, with the final egg containing a plastic 3D chick. Students also watched a video of a chick hatching, which allowed them to see how the chick used its egg tooth to break the shell open. The lesson concluded with everyone trying a hard-boiled egg on a stick. Along with the snack, the students learned fun facts, such as chickens can see in color and can remember people. Students learned that eggs are very nutritious, with 13 different vitamins and minerals that nourish their brain, eyes, heart, and muscles. Presenters also explained how eggs are graded before they are sold in stores. The kids used a scale from the 1980s to weigh different sized eggs. Extra lesson plans were left with the teachers to help continue their embryology studies, including a copy of the book My Family Egg Farm, worksheets about the parts of an egg, and a booklet about the life cycle of chickens. Another article on the front page is entitled New Rules on Nursing Home Staffing Levels Unveiled. Requirements will be phased in over 5 years, with waivers available. The Biden administration introduced a controversial set of new regulations intended to increase staffing levels and improve patient care in nursing homes. The new staffing rule from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has faced fierce opposition from the industry and Republicans in Congress. It establishes, for the first time, national minimum staffing requirements for nursing homes that collect taxpayer money through Medicare and Medicaid-funded services. The staffing requirements will be phased in over the next 2 to 5 years. And CMS has made provisions to grant exceptions for care facilities in rural areas such as Iowa, where there's a shortage of available caregivers. In a written statement, the administration said it believes that by improving working conditions and wages, improvements in the recruitment and retention of direct care workers will follow, enabling nursing staff to provide safer, higher quality care to all residents. Inadequate staffing has long been considered the single biggest contributor to poor quality care in nursing homes and is a major recurring issue in Iowa nursing homes. According to data from CMS, 14% of Iowa's 422 nursing facilities were cited for insufficient staffing in fiscal year 2023. That's more than double the national average, which was 5.9%. Only five other states, Hawaii, Michigan, Montana, New Mexico, and Oregon, had a worse record of compliance with the sufficient staffing requirement. Iowa's neighboring states of Nebraska, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Missouri had no more than 2% to 6.8% of their facilities cited for insufficient staffing in 2023. Des Moines' Fleur Heights Center for Wellness and Rehabilitation has compiled Iowa's worst record of compliance with requirements for sufficient staffing levels. Over a 9-month period between May of 2023 and February of 2024, the home was cited but never fined 5 times for insufficient staff. Last November, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and 14 other Republican governors sent Biden a letter objecting to the new rule and arguing that the nursing home industry is facing a workforce crisis, particularly in rural areas. The governors predicted that minimum staffing levels would force over 80% of facilities nationwide to have more staff and result in many of them closing. CMS officials said Tuesday they don't expect the new rule to force any facilities to close, noting that some states have imposed even higher staffing level requirements with no resulting shutdowns. The new rule has been 2 years in the making, and CMS has fielded more than 46,000 public comments on it from caregivers, residents, industry representatives, and resident advocates. Toby S. Edelman, a senior policy attorney for the Center for Medicare Advocacy and a national expert on long-term care, noted Tuesday that the new rule announced this week establishes only the minimum permissible staffing levels care facilities must meet. The rule does not end the discussion about staffing levels, he said. Under federal rules issued earlier, all facilities are also required to conduct, at least annually, a facility assessment. This process requires each facility to determine the actual nursing needs of its own residents and to ensure that it has enough staff and that its staff have the necessary skills to meet its residents' needs. Properly implemented and enforced, the facility assessment process will require many facilities to implement higher staffing levels than the minimums announced today. The specific provisions of the new rule include elements related to staffing, public disclosure, and resident assessments. For nursing care, residents must receive at least 3.48 hours of nursing care per day, which would include at least 0.55 hours of care from a registered nurse per resident per day, as well as 2.45 hours of care from a certified nurse aide per resident per day. Around-the-clock nurse availability. All homes must have a registered nurse on site 24 hours per day, 7 days per week. The nurse must be available to deliver critical care to residents at any time. Self-assessments. Aside from meeting the new minimum standards, all facilities will be required to perform annual assessments to determine the actual level of staffing needed to meet all residents' needs. Those assessments, which will be more detailed than those currently required, are intended to address the fact that many care facilities already meet the new minimum standards, but are still failing to meet residents' needs due to heightened levels of acuity or the need for one-on-one supervision. Each facility will be required to at least develop a formalized plan to maximize their workforce recruitment and retention efforts. To help ensure compliance, CMS will also be requiring states to which much of the enforcement efforts are delegated to collect and report on the percentage of Medicaid payments spent on compensation for direct care workers and support staff. CMS has promised to publicly report the spending data collected by the states, and the states themselves will also be required to report facility-specific data on publicly accessible websites. The federal agency has also pledged $75 million to be spent on a national nursing home staffing campaign aimed at increasing the number of nurses working in long-term care facilities. As part of that effort, CMS will be providing financial incentives for nurses to work in nursing homes. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled Bridge Project: Animal Breeder Rules Advanced. The Fort Dodge City Council on Monday hired an engineering firm to design a bridge project on Fifth Avenue South. The small bridge is near the eastern end of Memorial Park Cemetery. The planned work includes replacing the bridge deck that vehicles drive on, plus repairing the curbs, joints, and stormwater inlets. A 5-foot-wide sidewalk will be added on the south side of the bridge. That work is scheduled to be done next year. Calhoun Burns and Associates of West Des Moines was hired to prepare the project plans at a cost of $49,725. In other business, the Council approved the second reading of a measure to impose more requirements on dog breeders. It would add these conditions to animal breeding permits, which are already required. The address and description of the type of premise where the breeding animal will be kept. If the breeding is to be done elsewhere, that address must also be provided. A veterinarian certificate confirming that the breeding animal has been vaccinated. A written statement from a veterinarian stating that the animal is healthy enough to breed, and a microchip number for the animal. The measure must be approved once more to become law. Turning to page 2, we find an article entitled "Senate Overwhelmingly Passes Billions in Aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan." The Senate has passed $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending the legislation to President Joe Biden after months of delays and contentious debate over how involved the United States should be in foreign wars. The bill passed the Senate on an overwhelming 79-18 vote. The vote was held on late Tuesday after the House had approved the package on Saturday. Biden, who worked with congressional leaders to win support, said in a statement immediately after passage that he will sign it Wednesday and start the process of sending weapons to Ukraine, which has been struggling to hold its front lines against Russia. Tonight, a bipartisan majority in the Senate joined the House to answer history's call at this critical inflection point, Biden said. The legislation would also send $26 billion in wartime assistance to Israel and humanitarian relief to citizens of Gaza, and $8 billion to counter Chinese threats in Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific. U.S. officials said about $1 billion of the aid could be on its way shortly, with the bulk following in coming weeks. In an interview with the Associated Press shortly before the vote, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, said that if Congress hadn't passed the aid, America would have paid the price economically, politically, and militarily. Very few things we have done have risen to this level of historic importance, he said. On the Senate floor, Schumer said the Senate was sending a message to U.S. allies. We will stand with you. Schumer and Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell made passage of the legislation a top priority, agreeing to tie the Ukraine and Israel aid to help ensure passage and arguing that there would be dire consequences for the United States and many of its global allies if Russian President Vladimir Putin's aggression is left unchecked. They worked with House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, to overcome seemingly intractable Republican opposition to the Ukraine aid in particular, eventually winning large majorities in both chambers. McConnell said in a separate interview before the vote that it is one of the biggest days in the time that I've been here. At least on this episode, I think we turned the tables on the isolationists, McConnell said. In the end, 31 Republicans voted for the aid package, 9 more than when the Senate passed a similar version in February, and a majority of the Senate GOP conference. The House approved the package in a series of 4 votes on Saturday, with the Ukraine portion passing 311-112. The $61 billion for Ukraine comes as the war-torn country desperately needs new firepower and as Russian President Vladimir Putin has stepped up his attacks. Ukrainian soldiers have struggled as Russia has seized the momentum on the battlefield and gained significant territory. Biden told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Monday the U.S. will send badly needed air defense weaponry as soon as the legislation is passed. The president has assured me that the package will be approved quickly and that will be powerful, strengthening our air defense as well as long-range and artillery capabilities, Zelensky said in a post on X on Monday. In an effort to gain more votes, Republicans in the House majority also added a bill to the foreign aid package that could ban the social media app TikTok in the U.S. if its Chinese owners do not sell their stake within a year. That legislation had wide bipartisan support in both chambers. The TikTok bill was one of several tweaks Johnson made to the package, and the Senate passed on February as he tried to move the bill through the House despite significant opposition within his conference. Other additions include a stipulation that $9 billion of the economic assistance to Ukraine is in the form of forgivable. On page 2, we find an article entitled, Five Migrants Die While Crossing the English Channel. Five people, including a child, died while trying to cross the English Channel from France to the UK. French authorities said Tuesday, just hours after the British government approved a migrant bill to deport some of those who entered the country illegally to Rwanda. The prefecture responsible for the north of France said in a statement authorities spotted several boats packed with immigrants off the coast of Pas-de-Calais, attempting to depart in the early morning. Several French Navy ships, including assistance and rescue tug Abielle Normandie, intervened to rescue a very overcrowded boat carrying more than 100 people on board, the statement emailed to the Associated Press said. They rescued several people, but unfortunately, five people have died, it said. And we will end with a reading of the Messenger editorial entitled Sign Up for Fun at Frontier Days. There are opportunities to get involved in upcoming festivities. Mention Frontier Days, and perhaps the first thing that comes to mind for many people is the massive parade that moves down almost the entire length of Central Avenue. It's a signature part of a traditional 3-day event that celebrates the frontier heritage of Fort Dodge and truly launches the summer season. In addition to the parade, Frontier Days features music, food, games, and live entertainment at the Fort Museum and Frontier Village. The 2024 version of Frontier Days is a little more than a month away. It will be held May 31, June 1, and June 2. The theme for this year, which is the 49th version of Frontier Days, is How the West Was Won. And that word won is spelled, in this case, O-N-E. There are ways for people to get involved. Each edition of Frontier Days features a Buckskinners camp spread out on the lawn at the south end of the museum campus. And throughout the site, there are individuals and businesses selling food and other items. People who are interested in being at Frontier Days as a reenactor in the Buckskinners camp, or who want to be a vendor at the event, must file an application to do so. Those applications are now available at fortmuseumfv.com. Any individual or group who wants to have a float in that big parade snaking down Central Avenue also needs to submit an application. Parade entry applications are also at fortmuseumfv.com. They are due May 17. Local kids also have a chance to get in on the Frontier Days action by entering a coloring contest. Two Western-themed pictures to color can be found on the Fort Museum's website. The coloring contest is divided into three age groups, 3 to 5 years, 6 to 8 years, and 9 to 11 years old. Coloring contest entries must be submitted by May 20. We encourage people to take advantage of these opportunities to get involved in Frontier Days. And that does it for today's reading of The Messenger for April 24, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.